Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Greg Erickson of the Alaska Budget Report, and Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. Steve, here in Anchorage, Title 21 is finally Title 21. Took many years in the making.
Yeah.
Although the mayor's critics are now saying maybe it's more like Title 18 and a half.
Yeah, there are
a number of parties here who are unsatisfied after all these years.
Yeah, so I guess it's good legislation. You have people on both sides of the issue that are angry at you, I guess. But one of the things that happened here, first of all, this is a blueprint of how Anchorage is going to be developed over the years and into the future. It lays out zoning laws and things and tells people where, what kind of structures can be built in what part of the city.
Setbacks also and
setbacks,
some,
yeah. Sidewalks, with, yeah, landscaping.
Landscaping, that's the word.
Yeah. One of the things it won't do is govern the way businesses, commercial businesses, are going to look, except for the big box stores. If you've got a Home Depot in the works, you're going to have to adhere to some standards. But this is something that got pulled out of the legislation on the night it was approved, and it caught a lot of people by surprise. There wasn't a lot of debate. This was something that was proposed by South Anchorage Assemblyman Chris Birch. He felt it was this was redundant. There were already regulations in place that governed this, and there was a vote. I think it wound up like 5-4, something like that, to pull this out. And that's what really upset a lot of the supporters of Title 21. A lot of people were angry over this particular move. That was one of the big points of contention the night it was approved.
I guess what we'll hear from now on, or for the foreseeable future, is people who will say, we ought to change Title 21, and the other side will say, we already did that.
Yeah, I imagine that this is going to be a living, breathing document. I think the people will go back in and try to tinker with it a little bit. We saw a lot of tinkering. Like you said, it took the better part of a decade, or maybe it did take a decade to get this thing to the point where it's finally been approved. At one point, Mayor Sullivan called in Dan Coffey as a consultant, and he went through Title 21.
Former assemblyman.
And so he proposed a lot of changes, and some of those were adopted as well. So this thing did change quite a bit.
Thank you. Paul, Shell announces it is suspending Arctic drilling. But like General MacArthur, mm-hmm. they also announced, we shall return. Quite a story.
Well, it is, and they've decided to pause this year. They had and send both of their drilling vessels back to Asia for repairs and refurbishment. They had several transportation problems involving those vessels this year. They had no problems in the exploratory drilling phase. They've had no drilling problem, but what they have had is transportation problems and fairly severe ones.
Is this a big setback for offshore drilling?
I don't think so. No, I don't. I'll tell you why. They're going to pause for a year. They're going to reevaluate their safety programs and where they are. I think next time they try this, it won't be one or two vessels. They'll have enough vessels on hand to take care of any problem. And I think in the long run, it'll actually do the offshore drilling up here a big favor, if you will, in that it will, in fact, make people focus on what they need to do to work in the Arctic.
Greg, you have any thoughts on the problems Shell's encountered in their decision?
Well, I think it's also true that they are sort of on the edge with the government regulatory authorities, particularly the federal government, of course, and it may well be that they were encouraged to take a time out, and had they not taken a time out, might have been forced to do so by the federal government.
Okay. Sticking with oil, Greg, distinguished economist Greg, Scott Goldsmith. You're distinguished too.
Yeah.
Scott Goldsmith, formerly of UAA, talked to the legislators and told them some things about oil and gas taxes and oil and gas policy. What do you have to say?
Scott is truly distinguished. I'd say he's probably generally thought of as the leading economist in Alaska these days. He was invited to testify by Representative Eric Fagee, the co-chair of the House Resources Committee, who's a strong supporter of rolling back oil taxes. And the central issue in oil tax debate for the last 3 years has really been what will happen in terms of oil industry investment if we cut our taxes and help the bottom line of these oil companies. If we reduce taxes by a dollar, will 10 cents come back to Alaska as additional investment, and what will that produce? Well, Scott Goldsmith, professor emeritus at the University of Alaska, basically came down and assumed that 100% of the money that goes into the oil company's bottom line from a tax cut would come back and would be invested in Alaska. Now, it's just not going to happen because the federal government takes its slice before the companies could reinvest it. But in any event, starting from that premise, and starting from the premise that it would be very productive, he analyzed the employment effects. And bottom line is, he said, you know, in many years, if we reinvested the money that we got from these new fields, that we could have 39,000 more jobs in Alaska by 2025 if his scenario turns out to be correct. Some wag said that economics is a crooked line between a unproven assumption and a foregone conclusion, and some people would argue that that's what this was as well. But I don't think it changed any minds on the oil tax issue.
Okay, thank you very much. Paul, the Alaska legislature continues to challenge the Obama administration on gun control laws and gun control orders. Lawmakers have been very active, yet at the same time, they've been up against the difficulty of state law can't trump federal law. What do you see?
I think it doesn't cost very much to stick a stick in the eye of the federal government. I think that's where we are here. There's a growing sense of frustration in the gun community, gun owner community, gun rights support community about the federal government's encroachment on the Second Amendment. I think the House and House Bill 69 voted 31-5. I think you see that frustration in play at that point. The bill is clearly unconstitutional. It violates the Primacy Clause in the Constitution. But it's a good way to tell the federal government we're mad, we're not going to take it anymore. And at the same time, the Senate hasn't acted on it yet, but Governor Parnell says he supports the bill. So it could wind up on the books, but it will mean very little.
And the other thing we should notice is a variety of legislation make its way through the legislature that would actually deal with Alaska laws and policies regarding firearms. They're not resolutions memorializing the President of the United States to do this or that. It will actually change policy.
Well, this,
for example, Stand Your Ground.
Now, Stand Your Ground, that's a very important piece of legislation. What this law would do if it were put on the books is supposedly make guns and ammo owned by Alaskans immune from federal law. I don't think we're going to see that.
It makes it a felony for any...
It also makes a felony for a federal agent. They could charge a federal agent with a felony, and wouldn't we love to see that, for trying to enforce federal law pertaining to ammunition, extended capacity magazine, semi-automatic rifles in the future. But
I wasn't aware that Governor Parnell had actually supported it.
I mean, think he said that either
today
or yesterday.
Yeah,
he did.
Last couple of days he
Greg,
said that.
Greg, you're in the Capitol on a regular basis. What does this look like in the Capitol building, the firearms issue? And I guess how much time is it taking, and is this really top of the head of people's agenda, or does it just look that way to outsiders?
I don't think it's at the head of the agenda. I certainly concur with Paul's analysis of what's going on. I have to say that in my own perception of those events there and watching it on a day-to-day basis, I think it's disgusting. I mean, these people raised their right hand and swore to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And I guess they somehow figure this is okay. But I, as Paul says, it's clearly unconstitutional. And
Steve, do you want to add one thing, and then we'll move on?
Yeah, just wouldn't a resolution be a lot quicker? I mean, legislatures, assemblies, they pass resolutions all the time. It's down, it's dirty, it puts your opinion on record. You send it off to the federal government, which probably throws it away. But it's going to have the same effect, right?
It would. And if you really wanted to make your point with the federal government and actually have a law that meant something, you could forbid municipalities and the state from spending a single penny or a moment of state employees' time helping federal officials enforce a law that deals with firearms.
Yeah.
And
that
would have had an effect.
Several
that's been done elsewhere and several other issues. That's correct. Okay.
You know, this is just, I'm sorry, I know you want to move on, but just one thing I wanted to say.
Too bad for you.
You know, just I worry about this creating a dangerous situation for federal law enforcement agents at some point in time.
Nothing's going to happen.
Yeah?
No,
you think so?
I don't think you'll find a state law officer who will arrest a federal officer. These guys are
just worried about it fueling
I
the sentiment
oh,
out
I
there.
So.
We have our police officers right now are, you know, they seem to be more it's a dangerous job anyways.
For individuals, yes.
I just wonder if this is just going to fuel more anti-government well, it is, of course.
Of course.
It's one thing to be mad at Congress and be mad at the president. That's fine. But folks who are out there on the front line, I don't know. I'm just worried about that aspect.
I don't think police officers will have a problem with each other. You might have your stray individual who thinks all of a sudden, well, the state says I can do this and you can't stop.
That's what I'm worried about.
That
you
could
just
be
hit
a problem.
It on the head. Yeah.
You just hit
it on the head. So, okay.
On the other hand, some people might argue that the people who we're worrying about here are not the people who read the newspapers. Steve, labor unrest continues here in Anchorage as the Sullivan administration draws more challenges to its changes in the labor laws, and that seems like we have a demo a week here.
Boy, this has really become a contentious, divisive issue. The mayor came out and said he wants to streamline bargaining, the bargaining process with city unions. He wants to put some cost-saving measures in place as well. He's trying to limit, roll back the power that unions have to negotiate labor contracts. And this has really set off all kinds of protests within the labor unions. We had a public hearing, I think it was Wednesday night at the Lusac Library. There were about 1,000 people that were estimated to be there. So this got a lot of interest, and it's sparked a little sort of a mini campaign on the radio, both sides airing their side to the public. And it's pretty contentious out there, what's going on. And now it'll supposedly come to a head on March 12th. That's when the assembly is scheduled to vote on this. But this is reminiscent of something that happened when Rick Meistrom was the chair of the assembly. This was probably back in the late 80s. He felt that the city workers had too much time off. They had too many days off, that they, you know, sick leave and things like that, and wanted to roll it back. And I can remember that they had at Central Middle School, they had a meeting, and he stood up on the stage and told city workers who jammed the place what he wanted to do. And they told him on no uncertain terms that one of the reasons why they wanted a city job is because of the benefits.
Well, he didn't have the votes then, I don't believe.
No, he was kind of venturing off on his own, and then he backed down. He said, okay, I didn't realize how strongly you felt about this. And he said, okay, I'll abandon this whole idea. And much credit to him for that, but I don't think this is going to have that kind of resolution. I think this is going to go to the mat with a vote.
Greg, one of the things that's surprised me some, not totally, but some, is that we haven't seen legislators who want to replicate the kind of legislation that Scott Walker got in Wisconsin in dealing with unions, or that has been implemented in other states. Is this something that the legislature has way, way too much to deal with, and they just don't want to deal with it, or there isn't much sentiment in that direction?
Well, I think you have to say that the business community in Alaska is less concerned about the power of labor unions, but that's just a hypothesis. Maybe it's they got too many other issues on their plate this time around.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed in Wisconsin is they were very concerned about labor costs driving business to other states, and we probably wouldn't have as much concern about that here.
Public employee labor unions, and public employee unions in Alaska, I think are considerably weaker, certainly at the state level, maybe in the Anchorage. I know the police and fire unions here are not weak.
Okay, once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald, and Greg Erickson. Greg, Medicaid. This is a story that's taking up a lot of press, and it's also taking up a lot of legislators' time in Juneau as we see how the various states, and especially ours, deal with the Obama administration's efforts to expand Medicaid. And now the Republican Party seems to be jumping in with taking an opinion.
The Medicaid expansion, which is part of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare is designed to bring health care to almost all Americans, and there's a big gap of people who are not covered either by private insurance or who don't have access currently to the government-funded Medicaid program for the poor. This would expand that program to cover about 40,000 people who are not now covered under the program. Federal government promising to pay 100% of the cost for the first 3 years and 95% for the next several years. Most states are going along with it and taking the federal money. But Governor Parnell, according to an AP story I just saw an hour ago, has said that he's not going to do it this year. Going to be very costly for the state because there's something called the Woodwork effect. The people who are eligible for Medicaid but aren't getting it right now, who will find themselves pretty much forced to get on the program. And the costs of those people only get covered about 50% by the feds if we don't expand Medicaid. If we do, we get 100% of that. So it's a complicated issue, but I think in the end it's going to cost the state quite a bit of money. The one concern is that the feds will pull the rug out from under us later on, and they say they'll give you 100%, but they in fact will not. I don't think that's a realistic fear, but it's certainly not impossible.
Steve.
Yeah, I was just going to add the same thing Greg just said, that in the comments made by the governor the other day, he is very worried about just the discourse that's going on in Washington, D.C. right now. And he's worried, the feds, I think, have said that they would fund this for 3 years.
At 100%.
At 100%.
And 90%.
He doesn't, and the governor is worried that after 3 years, they'll back out of it and the state will be holding the bag. And he's just really concerned about sequestration, the bipartisanship that's going on in D.C., and he basically came back and said, this is a broken system in D.C., and that was one of the reasons that he's decided to back out of this thing right now.
Okay, thanks, Steve, for explaining that to us. We need to hear that. Greg, I wanted to return to you. If I read your report correctly, there's something like 40,000 people who would benefit from this, and I believe, I was surprised, most of them would not be young people. They would be adults or young adults.
That's right. There are people, generally single people, or people with no dependent children, who are over 21 and under 65.
Okay, and what does this legislation or mean for emergency rooms, which now have to accept and just pay for some people who come in there and don't have the money to pay for anything?
Well, that's called uncompensated care, and hospitals generally accept whoever comes to the door at the emergency room, and I think in many places they're required to do that. They don't get paid for that, so they raise their rates to those of us who can pay, and we pay through higher insurance charges or higher rates if we're self-pay. And so there's some dispute about how significant this is, but the hospitals and the medical care providers are, of course, generally in favor of this because it increases their business. Another thing is that it will provide that it will save them from having to render all this uncompensated care if it is, in fact, a major issue.
And one final thing, Greg, it is noticeable that Republican governors in many other parts of the country have accepted the Obama proposal for Medicaid. Governor Chris Christie on Friday announced he would accept it, and basically he said, hey, the federal government's giving me free money, how can I turn it down?
Yeah,
but that doesn't, and Governor Scott of Florida accepted it, although he cited personal reasons involving his own experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing that's often lost sight of in the context of these numbers that get competing, the numbers get thrown around, is that these people who do not have coverage now, they might have cancer. And that you just can't get treatment if you don't have. And I think that there's a good chance that many of these people would be more productive members of society if they had the access to that kind of medical care that I think everyone should have a right to.
Okay, Steve McDonald, Anchorage Chamber President Andrew Halcrow, and Senator Bill Willikowski debate oil taxes before the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Halcrow was there pinch hitting for Governor Parnell, I guess is the way we could put it. The governor declined to participate, but Halcrow, who's a former legislator himself, mm-hmm. went in and took up the cudgels.
Yes, and he did a very good job, as did Senator Welikowski as well. Senator Welikowski is probably, he's certainly one of the big opponents to this. He and Hollis French and Senator Hollis French and Representative Lesguerre pretty much have fought this tooth and nail, that being the governor's plan to revamp oil production taxes on the North Slope. But this was, I think, a very worthwhile event. I wish they'd do this more often, not just the chamber, but other organizations as well. But to get these two fellows who are very bright, they're very well spoken, and they are armed with their facts. They got up there in front of a crowd at the Chamber of Commerce, and this was, I think, a sold out luncheon. It was a big luncheon. There was a lot of people who were very interested in what these two folks had to say. At the end of it all, I don't know if they changed anybody's mind, if anybody flipped from one side to the other, because you still have that issue of, I've got my numbers and you've got your numbers, and how did we get there and who do you believe, kind of thing.
Did it make good TV?
It did, I think so. I watched it on our website, ktuu.com, shameless plug, sorry, but we streamed the event live on the website, and so I was able to watch it there, and it was good. These guys were very articulate, they debated well, and it was a good program, and I think we should do that with more events. We had a program on about a week ago Wednesday now, where we had Senator Welikowski from Juneau, and we had Revenue Commissioner Brian Butcher in Anchorage, and we had, it wasn't supposed to be a debate. We tried to get the governor, but again, he didn't want to debate Welikowski at all. But it was an exchange of ideas, and there certainly is a big difference of opinion there.
Paul, you want to add your perspective here briefly?
Please.
No.
Yeah,
no. No, I agree with Steve. This is the kind of thing that, especially on an issue like this, that is so, it's been around for years, and we've been, mm-hmm. There have been columns and editorials and people slamming one another over this, and I think as the public really comes to understand this, to this kind of performance, that we'll actually make some progress. And I think Halcrow cleaned the floor with it, but that's just me.
You know, the one issue that gets me on this whole thing, the big question too, is just a year or so, and you'd know this better. The Democrats said, "Don't touch ACEs. ACEs doesn't need to be.
Great.
ACEs are great. But now they've got their own plan. So what's changed now? ACEs hands off now. All right, we
the
got
elections
a plan.
Changed.
Yeah,
now.
Right. So
well, declining oil production changed the view of the world.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
I mean, all of a sudden you're getting $1 billion less a year mm-hmm. out of that oil field. You've got to start saying to yourself, excuse me, if everybody out there says we're doing this wrong, maybe we need to take a look at it. And their plan actually is not horrible.
No.
I mean, it's not great, but it's not bad.
I think the one thing we got out of the Butcher Welikowski exchange on our program was that, there's some good ideas on both sides and maybe there's a way to compromise. Will that happen? Nah.
We're going to have to someday.
Let's go back to Greg Erickson. Greg, the legislature is controlled by one party. Both houses are controlled by one party, and the House has been controlled by one party for a long, long time now. What is the tenor of this legislature, and particularly how has it changed since our last legislature?
Well, it's certainly different from recent legislatures. And I think the biggest difference, well, there's a lot of little differences. Far fewer bills being introduced this year, for example. We've got 13 new members. That's a large number of new members out of 60. But I think the biggest thing is that the bipartisan coalition, Republicans and Democrats, that controlled the Senate for 6 years, I guess, I can't remember exactly how long it was, sort of were a filter so that radical ideas, either from the left or right, didn't get through the legislature.
When they advertised themselves as that.
That's true. That's exactly what they did. And suddenly there's the world has changed, and there's sort of a pent-up demand of, I'd say, pro-business legislation and social conservative legislation. We mentioned the Stand Your Ground law. There's abortion legislation being considered now, all social conservative issues. Legislation to amend the Constitution to basically make vouchers available to private schools, including perhaps religious schools. And on the business side, they pushed through a cruise ship a law weakening the pollution requirements for cruise ships, did that very rapidly, and didn't bother to talk to the Department of Fish and Game about.
I got a question for you. Couldn't the conservatives who are introducing this legislation, couldn't they say properly and straightly, this is what we were elected for, we're doing what the people who elected us wanted us to do?
Well, I'm certain that people who are introducing that legislation are saying that, and we'll see whether it works its way through the Senate. There's also clearly a much stronger commitment to restrain the budget this year, at least in the House. We don't know yet how the Senate is going to respond to that, and it's a big open question. But we're seeing the closeouts this week on the budgets, and House people are putting their pens where their mouths are and cutting these nickels and dimes.
And who in the Senate would be the most influential Senate members on finance matters?
Well, Pete Kelly, who is who's just elected to the Senate as co-chair of finance, and he was a lobbyist for the university for many years. So he, I think, has a perspective that may be a little different from the one that has come in the House.
A little different, too, is we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us on Alaska Edition. We'll see you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.